Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
My name is Father Steve Walusek. I am the Director of St. Peter's Seminary. It's my pleasure to welcome you here tonight to St. Peter's. I first of all must congratulate you on your bravery and courage in racing against the weather conditions to be here. I can tell that you really want to be here tonight. I'm glad you're here. St. Peter's Seminary, as many of you know, is the seminary of the Roman Catholic Episcopal Corporation of the Diocese of London and has been founded since 1912, began in St. Peter's Cathedral Rectory downtown, and then in 1926 was opened in this beautiful, bright, and mammoth building that we have now. And right now, St. Peter's Seminary is undergoing a major renovation that is targeted to be completed by the spring of 2020. So right now, a little bit over the halfway point of the complete and major renovations of our seminary building. So we're very glad that you're able to be with us during this time. Today, the church celebrates the feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. We have elevated it to the solemnity of St. Thomas Aquinas because our chapel is named after St. Thomas. So we celebrate a solemnity mass just before supper. We are having this wonderful talk given on this day of the celebration of St. Thomas's memorial. So welcome to you all. It's great to have you here, and this is a wonderful opportunity to be able to share our faith and share the tremendous foundations of our faith in the truth that has been taught to us through the great saints and doctors such as St. Thomas Aquinas. At this time, I'd like to turn to one of our long-standing members of the faculty of St. Peter's Seminary, Father Michael Creer, who has served on faculty as professor, spiritual director, also very much instrumental to the permanent diaconate formation program, and served with us for 50 plus years. So I now ask Father Creer to come forward and to welcome and introduce our guest speaker for tonight. Please.
Father Conley had a line about people coming to church. He said the word weather, and he saw people he never saw before. Amazing. My pleasure to introduce Herman tonight, and known him now for, it's only about 10 years, I think, known him personally, known him in town because of his signature red running shoes. Everybody knows that in London. Stopped wearing them, though, last year. So, however, we all knew Herman in town. Well, Herman sent me his CV, and there it is. He said, don't read it. So I won't. However, I was impressed, and I hadn't realized. And the summary says he's in print, radio and TV journalist, magazine editor, award-winning playwright for radio and stage, published novelist, essayist, and a short story writer. And you can read the titles in there. And most interesting, so there it is. Well, I thought I'll Google it, see what happens. So I did, and there were some wonderful comments there. Nancy Schaefer, I think her name is, so she says he's intelligent, original, and unconventional writer. And then another fellow, Ian Hunter, yes, we know him, uncowed by that contemporary ogre, the consensus. His ideas are never conventional, although often conservative, something quite different. They exemplify that most uncommon attitude, common sense. Unflagging curiosity about life and its significance. So that's what Ian said about you. And finally, another writer said, he digs deeply to get the kernel of truth into great writers, men like Flannery O'Connor, Walter Percy, G.K. Chesterton, Malcolm Uggeridge, Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Not bad. Well, that's Herman, the literary expositor. Herman, the convert to the Catholic faith. And Herman has been a convert now for 1984, you said, at some time today. And Mary Cahalan had him in the RCIA program. And Mary remembers you as being gentle, open, humble, and a good participant. So you got good marks from Mary on that. And his lovely artistic wife, I say that because Kirtley is an artist, she was received into the church just a few years ago when I was there for her. So here we have two people, converts to the faith. Kirtley's right back here, by the way. Yeah, that's his wife. All right. Solid practice of the faith. And he offered to review my book, The Art of the Confessor, but took a stance I never would have dreamt. He reviewed the book from the point of view of being a penitent of mine. He can talk, I can't. So that was it. He did a wonderful job reviewing the book, The Art of the Confessor, for the Catholic Register. Now, Herman, the family man and deep Londoner, married for 40 years, has three children and three grandchildren, a deep love and concern for them. He has a nice cozy little house on Rogers Street. And when you go there, it's a beautiful place, lovely decorative outside, but inside, you go in there and you want to browse and browse and browse. I go there hearing their confessions every 3 months, and I must say I'm distracted looking at all the memorabilia he has in his room, including a dial phone that works. So that's Herman. And he belongs as well to the Rinklings, a group imitating the Inklings. We call C.S. Lewis and Tolkien had that group, well, they had the Rinklings, and about 8 of them have been going for quite a few years. Finally, Herman, the Catholic apologist. Well, he's always struggled to make sense of the tensions in our church and world, constantly probing into the deepest mysteries of our Catholic faith and the direction of our popes, especially Pope Francis, the monumental earthquakes in our church and hierarchy. But like the irascible St. Jerome and the controversial biblical scholar J.L. McKenzie, when you cut him, he always bleeds Catholic. And I look forward to people who might disagree, do they bleed Catholic ultimately? So Herman, Aquinas, and Chesterton to conclude. How are they similar? All three are big men. Big in body, big in mind, big in spirit. All three. And one thing about Aquinas, a line I want to use, many would say about St. Thomas Aquinas, they would call him an empirical realist because he could organize so-called common sense in a reasonable way and make it lead ultimately to God. No small compliment. That's Aquinas. But Chesterton and Herman, I think, have that same quality. And so, without any more ado tonight, I'd like to present Chesterton a la Herman Gooden.
All right, are we checking out the sound and my microphone? Thank you very much for that not quite exhaustive introduction. I thank you for all your work in arranging to have me speak here. It's an absolute honor to be addressing particularly in this place, on this day, this feast day of Blessed St. Thomas, and to be in an institution where the library just across the way has perhaps the most extensive collection of G.K. Chesterton that you'll find in any branch library in this town. So I'm delighted to be here on this day. Also a day I'll be talking about G.K. Chesterton, far and away St. Thomas's most insightful biographer. And here we go. I call this talk G.K. Chesterton and the Gift of Gratitude. I first became aware of G.K. Chesterton, 1874 to 1936, in my late 20s, on a literary tip from my friend Jeff Sessinch. "I think you'll like this guy," he said, plucking a copy of his selected essays from a shelf at City Lights Bookshop, where I was working as a clerk, and dropping it onto the counter. Oh, gross and magnificent understatement. Over the course of my reading life, I've known dozens of instances when I first knocked back a certain writer's book that goes down with such added delight that I hate myself for not being able to slow down to make it last. And as when the final page of that first book hoves into view, I nervously start to ponder whether this writer has written much else, and what are the odds that there might be anything else in their canon that's a fraction so good as this. It's an addictive sort of predicament, for sure. But if you're going to get hooked on any writer, I would recommend Mr. Gilbert Keith Chesterton as the perfect gateway stimulant. He is such a prodigiously generous supplier of words that there will be no need to face the dreadful prospect of going cold turkey for many years to come. As I identified with Chesterton so immediately and so strongly, I'm glad the introduction wasn't made any sooner, that my character and literary proclivities were more or less established before he arrived on my scene. We're both inclined to portliness. We both have walrus mustaches. We share a birthday. I do not harbor pagan superstitions, but I must admit, the sky cracked open, and I was suddenly bathed in a cone of celestial light when I discovered that coincidence. And we both enjoyed the composition of humorous essays. The overlap between us, cue Twilight Zone music, was a little spooky. I admire the man tremendously, but I'd hate to be accused of aping him. Of course, the date, my birth, was my parents' idea, though I'm not sure they sat down with a calendar for 1952, circled the 29th of May, and said, let's shoot for that one. The mustache, rotundity, and writing I came up with on my own. Yet even arriving in my life as late as he did, the scope for influence was still there. When he hasn't formed, he's at least firmed up a number of my convictions about journalism and literature, society and the family, and he played no small part in calling my bluff on my perpetually postponed showdown with Christianity, dragging me, not quite kicking and screaming, into the Roman Catholic fold. There are dozens of writers I admire, but Chesterton and Dr. Samuel Johnson, 1709-84, are heroes. Dr. Johnson, I might mention, shares a birthday with my brother Ted. What were my parents trying to get at? Both these men were the subjects of sprawling, multi-volume, very frank and very indulgent biographies written shortly after their deaths by people who know them well. James Boswell's 1,200-pager for Johnson and Maisie Ward's more modest 920 pages for Chesterton. As a near contemporary and friend, as well as his publisher, together with her husband, Frank Sheed, Maisie ran the dynamic Catholic publishing house of Sheed and Ward. She knew Chesterton the man in a way that no subsequent biographer ever will. In spite of all their reported weaknesses and fears, contradictions and warts, the portraits that emerge are riveting in their originality, wisdom, kindness, and goodness. Both men came with so many different parts, yet both were so completely of a piece, were such unshakably consistent exemplars of their own true selves in every time and circumstance. They didn't have to become meek dopes in order to become Christians. Their faith didn't rest upon powder kegs of doubt or uncertainty that were too dangerous to examine. They didn't stand in judgment of others of differing views, but instead engaged and wrestled with them whenever possible and had enormous fun in the process. While Johnson's readiness to suffer fools gladly probably wasn't as pronounced as Chesterton's, the sheer conviviality of both these physically substantial and quintessentially English gents would make them ideal models for Toby Jugs. In my talk this evening, I hope to sketch out a broad outline of Chesterton's life and career with a particular emphasis on the key years of his intellectual and spiritual formation. I'll also give you some sense of the staggering range of his literary output while pointing out those works which I believe to be the most significant. I warn you up front that if I should seem to be jumping around a bit, chronologically or thematically, well, that's not exactly an accident. The proper treatment of a man as unorthodoxly orthodox as Chesterton kind of demands it. What will be consistently woven right through this talk, however, is the engagingly provocative and stimulating voice of Chesterton himself. And many of the quotes I'll be sharing with you, perhaps even a slight majority, will be expressions of one or the other of two themes which I consider to be the big overarching ideas of the Chestertonian philosophy. And these are, one, your ancestors probably weren't all that stupid or wicked. There's a lot to be said for tradition. And two, life is a gift. Every gift has a giver. That giver deserves thanks. Today, 83 years after his death, new collections of Chesterton's work are still being unearthed and published. Of course, stray essays and poems are suddenly discovered, and whenever enough of these accumulate, they are herded between covers. But even a lost novel made its debut as recently as 2001. Basil Howe, a metaphysical romance composed in his 19th year, was assembled from a cache of 19th century notebooks that unexpectedly turned up in the bottom of a trunk of non-literary paraphernalia following the death of Chesterton's last secretary, Dorothy Collins. More than 100 books were published in his lifetime, and if a tally ever is reached, the total number of works published under the name of Gilbert Keith Chesterton will certainly add up to more than 200 separate volumes. usually the only writers who compile such staggering monuments to literary industry. Come on down, Barbara Cartland, are the worst kind of hacks, or are good enough writers who establish a narrow turf which they can easily work over and over again. What astonishes one in appraising the work of Chesterton is the number of literary categories in which he excelled. Indeed, he seems to have expended his gifts so lavishly and diffusely that the academic curators of literary reputation have simply never known what to make of him. One of the most frequently quoted authors in the English-speaking world, he is much more known of than known. He is much more cited for his aphoristic shards that illuminate some particular point than acknowledged for the totality of his thought. Quite maddeningly, one of the quotes most frequently attributed to him, when a man stops believing in God, he doesn't then believe in nothing, he believes in anything, isn't his. It could have been. It pretty well has the right swing, but it just isn't. So here's one from his book, Heretics, that marks out the same sort of territory. Take away the supernatural, and what remains is the unnatural. In addition to writing too much about everything, Chesterton further confounded the expectations of sober-minded readers by committing the literary equivalent of refusing to color inside the prescribed lines. Maisie Ward observed that a man starting to write a thesis on Chesterton's sociology once complained bitterly that hardly any of his books were indexed, so he had to submit to the disgusting necessity of reading them all through. For some striking view on sociology might well be embedded in a volume of art criticism or be the center of a fantastic romance. Ward maintained that this refusal to write about one thing at a time and keep his subjects and themes inside their own airtight containers wasn't a mark of sloppiness or negligence, but rather was a reflection of what many of us find so uniquely compelling about Chesterton as a writer, that his, according to Ward, was a philosophy both universal and unified. Early on in my search for anything else he'd written, oh, I've got to get my one prop this evening, just a second. I know people like audiovisual aids and, you know, PowerPoint presentations, but this is the 19th century version of that kind of talk. Well, if you're a kind of employee, you're kind of a brassy guy. Just sort of maybe even prone on a little bit. Sure, that would be good, folks. Okay. Early on in my search for anything else he'd written, I happened upon one of his harder to find titles, his 1904 critical monograph on the Victorian allegorical painter G.F. Watts. All that I knew Watts for was his single most famous painting, a dank and grim image of a blindfolded woman sitting on top of a globe in a posture of despair as she plucks at the last remaining string on a broken lyre. To which she is chained. I don't think I even knew that Watts, it might seem perverse, called this painting Hope. I belong to a Christian men's reading club that had been meeting once a month for the last quarter century, and a theme that comes up like a startling bulletin at every other one of our meetings is, oh man, has the church ever been so abysmally threatened than it is today? Granted, the shameful events of the last year have at least provided a little novelty for us in shifting the sharpest points of that threat from outside the walls of the church to inside, but whenever our group really gets flapping about in its headless, baptized chickens of the apocalypse mode, I attempted to read them this paragraph in which Chesterton describes the growing sense of meaning that dawns on a hypothetical viewer as he stares into the murky depths of Watts' most famous painting. He sees something for which there is neither speech nor language, which has been too vast for any eye to see and too secret for any religion to utter, even as an esoteric doctrine. Standing before that picture, he finds himself in the presence of a great truth. He perceives that there is something in man which is always apparently on the eve of disappearing, but never disappears. an assurance which is always apparently saying farewell, and yet illimitably lingers. A string which is always stretched to snapping, and yet never snaps. He perceives that the queerest and most delicate thing in us, the most fragile, the most fantastic, is in truth the backbone and indestructible. He knows a great moral fact, that there never was an age of assurance, that there never was an age of faith. Faith is always at a disadvantage. It is a perpetually defeated thing which survives all its conquerors. This brilliant formulation of the inextinguishable dynamic of that religion which is founded on a man who overcame public execution on a cross is not to be found in any of Chesterton's celebrated works of apologetics, but incidentally turns up in one of his least known books, in which he pays tribute to a largely forgotten artist. Yeah, that's good. Thank you very much. Another complaint that our intellectual superiors lob at Chesterton when they pay him any mind at all is that his intuitive, exuberant, and paradox-packed prose lacks intellectual grounding and rigor. In other words, his manner of thinking is altogether too mercurial, and he's way too funny. I get it. If you're in the business of baffling and intimidating people, of putting their critical faculties to sleep so you can pound any sort of insane nonsense into their heads, such as the discovery that human beings have been mistaken for untold millennia in their assumption that there were only two sexes, and that one of those sexes has always been toxic, by the way, then you will not tolerate writing of any verve or wit that threatens to wake your readers up. In one of his very first published essays that brought a broad public notice, Chesterton expressed his uneasiness with Britain's waging of the Boer War, sensing that this pushback against colonial independence had more to do with protecting certain Britain's financial interests than any vital or valid interest of Britain as a whole. When political leaders and editorial writers tried to suppress a rising tide of doubt by declaring this skirmish to be an unassailable matter of patriotic principle, Chesterton lampooned their fraudulent jingoism by means of one of his most potent weapons, comic analogy. "My country, right or wrong, is a thing that no patriot would think of saying except in a desperate case. It is like saying, my mother, drunk or sober." No doubt, if a decent man's mother took to drink, he would share her troubles to the last. But to talk as if he would be in a state of gay indifference as to whether his mother took to drink or not is certainly not the language of men who know the great mystery." End quote. As a frequent target of Chesterton's wit as complacent oafs who govern badly was a group at whose hands we suffer today as never before, progressive reformers of limited vision who believe the surest way forward is to heedlessly tear down what has come before. Here is a particularly rich analogy Chesterton penned in 1905 to illustrate his abiding belief that in all likelihood our predecessors and elders weren't complete idiots and probably had very good reasons for seeing and outfitting the world around them in the way that they did. Quote, "Suppose that a great commotion arises in the street about something, let us say a lamppost, which many influential persons desire to pull down. A gray-clad monk, who is the spirit of the Middle Ages, is approached upon the matter, and begins to say in the arid manner of the schoolman, let us first of all consider, my brethren, the value of light, if light be in itself good. At this point, he is somewhat excusably knocked down. All the people make a rush for the lamppost. The lamppost is down in 10 minutes, and they go about congratulating each other on their unmedieval practicality. But as things go on, they do not work out so easily. Some people have pulled the lamppost down because they wanted the electric light. Some because they wanted old iron. Some because they wanted darkness because their deeds were evil. Some thought it not enough of a lamppost. Some too much. Some acted because they wanted to smash municipal machinery. Some because they wanted to smash something. And there is war in the night. no man knowing whom he strikes. So gradually and inevitably, today, tomorrow, or the next day, there comes back the conviction that the monk was right after all, that all depends on what is the philosophy of light. Only what we might have discussed under the gas lamp, we now must discuss in the dark. Chesterton's lifelong conviction that whenever possible we should resist the impulse to tear structures down and start over from scratch also pertained, indeed particularly pertained, in the matter of religion. I initially worried that in joining the Catholic Church and aligning myself with this most tradition-bound of all earthly institutions, I might simultaneously be committing an act of contemporary defection that would somehow take me out of the life that was mine to live in the here and now. More than anyone else, it was Chesterton who showed me that when cynics dismiss tradition as the dead hand of history, as this leaden imposition of defunct conventions and outdated mores that only obstruct our progress and need to be jettisoned forthwith, they were not, in fact, propounding some wonderful unshackling, but a crippling amputation that would hobble any hope of real progress. He understood that the most fruitful way to proceed was not to discard tradition and replace it with something new, but to employ it to build something better. A full 14 years before crossing the Tiber himself, Chesterton praised the Catholic Church for getting this formula right in a column for The Nation about Cardinal Newman's An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine. A man who was always going back and picking to pieces his own first principles may be having an amusing time, but he is not developing as Newman understood development. Newman meant that if you wanted a tree to grow, you must plant it finally in some definite spot. It may be, I do not know and I do not care, that Catholic Christianity is just now passing through one of its numberless periods of undue repression and silence. But I do know this, that when the great flowers break forth again, the new epics and the new arts, they will break out on the ancient and living tree. They cannot break out upon the little shrubs that you are always pulling up by the roots to see if they're growing. Chesterton understood that honoring tradition is not some cowardly expression of nostalgia. You aren't hiding out in the past because you're too scared to confront some present predicament. You are mustering seasoned recruits to take part in the present struggle. Or, as Chesterton expressed this in 1908, tradition means giving votes to the most obscure of all classes, our ancestors. It is the democracy of the dead. Tradition refuses to submit to the small and arrogant oligarchy of those who merely happen to be walking about. All democracies object to men being disqualified by the accident of birth. Tradition objects to their being disqualified by the accident of death. That is another quote that predates Chesterton's entry into the Catholic Church by more than a decade, but look how perfectly it chimes with this explanation given by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger in a 1997 interview when he was asked what part tradition plays in the ongoing life of the Church. Quote, "The Church lives not only synchronically, but diachronically as well. This means that it is always all, even the dead, who live and are the whole Church. That it is always all who must be considered in any majority in the Church. The Church lives her life precisely from the identity of all the generations, from their identity that overarches time, and her real majority is made up of the saints. Every generation tries to join the ranks of the saints, and each makes its contribution, but it can do that only by accepting this great continuity and entering into it in a living way." End quote. The adjective most frequently employed to describe G.K. Chesterton's phenomenal literary productivity is inexhaustible. In 1910 alone, he published 5 separate volumes, one novel, The Ball and the Cross, an extended summarization of his political and sociological convictions called What's Wrong with the World, his biography, Critical Study of William Blake, and 2 compendiums of essays, Alarms and Discursions, and 5 Types. Every year of his publishing life, at least one collection would appear of the best of the essays he routinely published in a dozen different magazines and papers. Through the 1980s and 90s, Ignatius Press published the 37 separate volumes that made up their G.K. Chesterton collected works. Typically, each volume in that heroic edition comprises what had originally been four or five separate books. The volume I most treasure is number 11, which contains 11 different plays by Chesterton. I'd previously heard of three of them and been unable to find copies of any of them, and all of his writings about his good friend and philosophical adversary, George Bernard Shaw. A full 10 of those 37 volumes are devoted to just the essays he contributed to the Illustrated London News from 1905 to 36, the vast majority of which had never previously been reprinted. His 31-year run in the Illustrated News spanned precisely half of his entire life, and those 10 volumes provide an excellent survey of the way in which his thinking developed throughout his maturity. But we won't really have a collected edition that even begins to exhaust the inexhaustible until some suicidal publisher recklessly decides to gather up the 12 years of weekly essays he contributed to the Daily News from 1901 to 1913, a collection that would chart his increasing disenchantment with the Liberal Party, whose house organ it was. Or the occasionally interrupted 25-year run of the more radical Eyewitness, started up by his younger brother Cecil Chesterton in 1911. A bankruptcy motion occasioned the paper's redubbing in 1912 as The New Witness, and then it passed into Gilbert's editorial hands following Cecil's death in World War I, and was latterly known as GK's Weekly, until it closed up shop for good shortly after Gilbert's death. If it hadn't been for Chesterton's love for his more hot-headed brother and his ardent wish to pay lasting homage after Cecil's premature death, I doubt that Gilbert's commitment to perpetuating this predominantly political paper would have been so absolute. Certainly, those who loved Gilbert best and wished him to achieve the finest work of which he was capable regarded the multi-named paper as a distraction that drained off energy that could have been put to better use. That last self-referential name, by the way, was forced on the unassertive GKC by the paper's anxious accountants, who saw it as their best chance to possibly achieve something approximating solvency. But the lost and scattered writings I would most like to see gathered up are those he contributed as a teenager to The Debater, a student paper with a circulation of about 100, which he and a handful of chums in the junior debating club started up when they were attending St. Paul's School in Hammersmith, London. And for the sake of completion, perhaps they could throw in as an appendix Chesterton's very first, never published book, The History of Kids, which John Sullivan tells us in a 1974 essay was dictated to an aunt at the age of 3. The transcript signed by his father. In his 2008 study, Chesterton and the Romance of Orthodoxy, William Audy focuses on Chesterton's coming of age and devotes nearly 50 deliciously detailed pages to the activities of the Junior Debating Club. These perpetually hungry Victorian boys gathered together in one another's homes after school and through the holidays to gorge themselves on tea and buns and books, and enthusiastically recorded their every discovery and breakthrough in the pages of their paper. A three-hour reading of the poetry, you think you're getting a lot of reading tonight, hey? Eh? 3-hour reading of the poetry of Walt Whitman so elevated their spirits that they described it as a seance. As middle-aged men, they would hold jolly reunions of their club in hotel meeting rooms, and a few sheets to the wind, no doubt, would prop each other up as they bellowed out their club song, set to the tune of My Darling Clementine. I'm a member, member of the JDC. I'll belong to it forever. Don't you wish that you were me? In sharp contrast to the curiosity and high spirits that drove the JDC in the classroom, in the classroom, Chesterton was decidedly not a distinguished student. Unnaturally subdued and inattentive, he only spoke if he was deliberately summoned, and more often than not had to admit that he hadn't been paying attention and could the teacher please repeat the question. On the page, he wasn't much better focused and was inclined to run off on supplementary tangents that missed the main point of any given assignment. Indeed, he actually had some teachers who thought he might be a moron. A perpetual doodler in margins, his skills as a sketch artist were pronounced. Friends who cared about the pristine condition of their books would not lend them to Chesterton, lest they come back irretrievably illuminated. In an essay on Chesterton in his Lives of the Wits, Hesketh Pearson quotes Chesterton's mother as saying, "I always give money to pavement artists, as I'm quite certain that is how Gilbert will end." He certainly seemed to be unteachable in any ordinary sense, and the dreamy and distracted boy, who actually was beanpole thin in his adolescence, was once reamed out in front of the entire class by an exasperated form master who said, "You know, Chesterton, if we could open your head, we should not find any brain, but only a lump of white fat." But his friends, who knew what he was capable of in the extracurricular realm, and who repeatedly appointed him as the leader of their club and editor of their paper, because he was the one who gave their enterprise most of its direction and drive, held a much truer valuation of his extraordinary gifts. Audie reprints an early essay on dragons, which Maisie Ward had merely cited in her biography, saying that its arrival in the pages of their homespun periodical caused his chums to look up with arched eyebrows to proclaim, "This is literature." This remarkable essay by a barely 16-year-old Chesterton opens thus. "The dragon is certainly the most cosmopolitan of impossibilities. His eccentric figure has walked through the romances of all ages and all nations. It is a noticeable fact that many races, far separated by oceans and by ages and differing in language, customs, and surroundings, have nevertheless evolved similar creatures in the realm of the imagination. In nearly all legends, Greek, Norse, Celtic, Semitic, medieval, and Japanese, this scaly intruder has appeared from the earliest times and appeared apparently with the sole object of being killed, whether by the lance of St. George, the club of Heracles, the sword of Siegfried, or the arrows of Hiawatha." William Audie remarks on this early appearance of the brilliant wordplay that would always be a highlight of Chesterton's writing, but also notes how this essay's conclusion seems to portend what would turn out to be his literary mission statement. It is almost as though he has always known that his life was to be spent doing battle with dragons, writes Audie. Already he was on the lookout for them, and already he had identified them as being representatives of the prevailing culture. This early essay concludes that the modern dragon has become more circumspect. He doesn't see the good of going about as a roaring lion, but seeks what he may devour in a quiet and respectable way, behind many illustrious names and many imposing disguises, behind the scarlet coat and epaulets, behind the ermine tippet and the counselor's robe, behind, alas, the black coat and white tie, behind many a respectable exterior in public and in private life. We fear that the dragon's flaming eyes and grinning jaws, his tyrannous power and his infernal cruelty sometimes lurk. Reader, when you or I meet him, under whatever disguise, may we face him boldly and perhaps rescue a few captives from his black cavern. May we bear a brave lance and a spotless shield through the crushing melee of life's narrow lists. And may our wearied swords have struck fiercely on the painted crests of imposture and injustice when the dark herald comes to lead us to the pavilion of the king." 16 years old. The poet Walter de la Mare, 1873 to 1956, 1 year older than Chesterton, and therefore not part of his circle, was also enrolled at St. Paul's School, where he sang in the choir until his voice broke. Did he hoard old copies of the debater in some cupboard? Did this old essay possibly influence Delamere as he composed a quatrain in tribute of the time of Chesterton's death, in which he outfitted his subject with the accoutrements of a noble slayer of dragons? Chesterton's widow, Frances, included Delamere's verse on her husband's funeral card. Night of the Holy Ghost, he goes his way. Wisdom is motley, truth is loving jest. The mills of Satan keep his lance in play. Pity and innocence, his heart at rest. Unlike nearly all of his friends on the Debater, when their time at St. Paul's School was done, Chesterton did not go on to academic studies at one of the big universities, but instead enrolled at the Slade School of Art. In signing on for an education in art, I think he was hoping that a curriculum which emphasized the work of his hands over the work of his brain would allow him more leeway to follow his own intellectual instincts and enthusiasms. While no instructor declared him a dunce at the Slade, he made no deep and lasting friendships there and expended much of his energy in resisting the decadence and nihilism affected by so many of his instructors and fellow students. Looking back on his student years in a chapter of his autobiography, which is subtitled How to Be a Lunatic, Chesterton writes of the psychological and moral rot which he sensed was baked in to the then prevailing artistic fashion of Impressionism. Quote, I think there was a spiritual significance in Impressionism in connection with this age as the age of skepticism. I mean that it illustrated skepticism in the sense of subjectivism. Whatever may be the merits of this as a method of art, it naturally lends itself to the metaphysical suggestion that things only exist as we perceive them, or that things do not exist at all. The philosophy of Impressionism is necessarily close to the philosophy of illusion, and this atmosphere also tended to contribute, however indirectly, to a certain mood of unreality and sterile isolation that settled at this time upon me, and I think upon many others, end quote. Chesterton soon came to realize that he did not have the disposition or appetite to become a full-on visual artist, and wasn't that interested in developing his sketching talents further. His brother said of him that he shrank from the technical toils of art as he has never shrunk from the technical toils of writing. William Audy speculates that he may have enrolled the Slade as an act of filial homage. The shy and broad-minded Edward Chesterton, an easygoing realtor by day with the family firm of Chesterton Estate Agents, which still operates today in parts of London, was himself a dab cartoonist, and some of Chesterton's earliest memories center on the fun he had with his father creating a toy theater and populating it with cardboard heroes and villains and, yes, dragons. Right up until his death, Edward Chesterton kept amazingly elaborate scrapbooks of newspaper clippings, publishers' advertisements, playbills, and other ephemera concerning the progress of his oldest son's career, suggesting that the vicarious investments of his father-son team moved both ways. For his second and final year of higher education, Chesterton left the Slade for its affiliated University College, where he majored in history and political economy. William Audy notes that one of his professors later remarked that when Chesterton was at the Slade, he always seemed to be writing, and when he was listening to lectures on other subjects, he was always drawing. While he didn't have to spend so much time that second year fending off what he instinctively regarded as poisonous ideologies, he didn't see that it was doing him much good either, and Chesterton packed in formal education altogether in the spring of 1895 without earning any sort of degree. For the next 6 years, until he got married, Chesterton worked as a publisher's assistant at the house of Fisher Unwin, and on the side continued writing and started to land occasional and unusually unsigned book reviews in literary periodicals like the Academy, the Quarto, the Bookman, and the Speaker. Throughout this whole period of philosophical testing and questing, Chesterton keenly felt the loss of day-to-day fellowship with his old friends from the JDC. In a little poem in one of his notebooks, he wrote, "Tea is made. The red fog shut round the house, but the gas burns. I wish I had at this moment round the table a company of fine people. Two of them are at Oxford, and one in Scotland, and two at other places. But I wish they would all walk in now, for the tea is made." Maisie Ward fruitly devotes an entire chapter in her biography to the notebooks and letters he was writing at this time. In these dashed-off musings from his late adolescence and early manhood, we can trace the formation of this genius in the bud as he sorts his way through the prevailing intellectual fashions of the day, and respectfully pushes himself away from the wispy Unitarianism espoused by his classically liberal parents, and tentatively, fitfully, contemplates the attractions of a more traditional and rigorously defined Christianity. The notebooks are a place where he can take ideas for a walk, just to see where his mind wants to go. He entitles a short poem, Parables. There was a man who dwelt in the East centuries ago, and now I cannot look at a sheep or a sparrow, a lily or a cornfield, a raven or a sunset, a vineyard or a mountain without thinking of him. If this be not to be divine, what is it? To follow JDC member E.C. Bentley, who went on to write the seminal detective novel Trent's Last Case, a 20-year-old Chesterton wrote about a transcendental experience he underwent at this time. Inwardly speaking, I have had a funny time, a meaningless fit of depression, taking the form of certain absurd psychological worries came upon me. And instead of dismissing it and talking to people, I had it out and went very far into the abysses indeed. The result was that I found things, when examined, necessarily spelt. Such a mystically satisfactory state of mind that without getting back to earth, I saw lots that made me certain it is all right. The vision is fading into common day now, and I am glad. The frame of mind was the reverse of gloomy, but it would not do for long. It is embarrassing talking with God face to face, as a man speaketh to his friend. How characteristic that this natural-born man of letters, who was beginning to discern an imperative to commit himself to the word that was made flesh and dwelt among us, should, in a time of spiritual crisis, construe signs of reassurance and hope by what they spelt. And just as characteristically, within a couple days, he followed up that letter to Bentley with another note in which he recast his divine encounter as a joke. A cosmos one day, being rebuked by a pessimist, replied, "How can you, who revile me, consent to speak by my machinery? Permit me to reduce you to nothingness, and then we will discuss the matter. Moral? You should not look a gift universe in the mouth." If I should ever be granted an audience with Chesterton for 30 seconds, once I'd thanked him for all those marvelous books, I would like to tell him a variation on this joke that I heard from my friend Doug Moore. In this one, the pessimist tells God that anyone could have made a better world than this one, and as he bends down to scoop up a clump of earth to show him how it might be done, God grabs him by the arm and says, "Hey, get your own damn dirt." So here, at the exploratory and sporadic outset of his life as a professional writer, we see that Chesterton had fastened on to the single most foundational idea that will, overtly or subtly, inform virtually every article and poem and book that he writes until the end of his days. And that is that all life, that existence itself, is a gift, and that every gift has a giver, and that giver deserves thanks. When Chesterton later reflected on how he eventually came to Christian belief, he recalled dabbling in spiritualism and Ouija boards just long enough to get sickened, to attain what he called a bad smell in the mind. There were dark powers to be tapped into, but Chesterton knew enough to know that he wanted nothing more to do with them. He turned and walked away, shut that door for good, but still he was spiritually hungry. He hung on to the idea of God by what he called a thin thread of thanks. He didn't particularly hunger for heaven or righteousness or salvation. All he really wanted was someone to say thank you to. That enormous impulse of gratitude is, I suspect, fairly rare. If you don't feel it in any measure, then I expect that Chesterton is not your man. Chesterton found that when he began to cultivate gratitude for life itself, he received yet another quite unexpected gift. It brought him peace of mind. He no longer had cause to go tumbling into psychological abysses. Whereas Impressionism had fostered an ever-shifting subjectivism where things only existed as he perceived them or might not exist at all, gratitude for life fostered a rock-solid sense of reality. Now he was able to take it on trust that things really are what they are. I'm reminded of that rather strange expression we have. Let's take that as a given. What we mean by that is that there's no getting around a given or a gift. It commands a sort of precedence in that it must be acknowledged and taken into proper account before you can proceed or try to build anything more at all. And this Chesterton was now prepared to do. He gratefully acknowledged that he was the blessed recipient of the greatest gift there was. If he didn't yet know precisely in which creedal direction he would be expressing all the gratitude that was now suddenly flooding his heart, he figured that out in a trice when he fell in love at first sight with a woman who wore a simple crucifix around her neck. A woman, he said, who practiced her Anglo-Catholic religion with the same no-nonsense efficiency as she tended her garden. He was sure he'd known happiness before he met Francis Bloch, but nothing like this. When he knew his love was returned and that their future would be together, he wrote her a third-person narrative outlining his previous life and concluded it like this. There are four lamps of thanksgiving always before him. The first is for his creation out of the same earth with such a woman as you. The second is that he has not, with all his faults, gone after strange women. You cannot think how a man's self-restraint is rewarded in this. The third is that he has tried to love everything alive, a dim preparation for loving you. And the fourth is that no words can express that. Here ends my previous existence. Take it, it led me to you. There was really only one more thing that needed to fall into place before the full literary phenomenon of G.K. Chesterton could be properly launched on an unsuspecting world. This wildly impractical wizard of words needed a manager, someone who could organize and guide his professional affairs and see that he met his deadlines and got to necessary meetings in good time and was appropriately turned out when he did so. Ideally, he would acquire a manager who recognized his true value and cared for him enough not to exploit him. But of course, managers like that don't exist. But wives do. Maisie Ward writes, one of Gilbert's friends remarked that Gilbert's life was unique in that never having left home for a boarding school or university, he passed from the care of his mother to the care of his wife. I think, too, that the degree of his physical helplessness affected all who came near him with the feeling that while he might lead them where he would intellectually, it was their task to look after a body that would otherwise be wholly neglected. Francis's widowed mother was so leery of the shambolic weirdo with a low-paying job who was courting her daughter that it took her 3 years until she was sufficiently convinced of her would-be son-in-law's prospects to let the wedding go ahead. I consider it a real testament of Chesterton's chivalric heart that not only did he not lace Mrs. Blogg's tea with a sprinkling of arsenic so as to speed things along, he wrote his fiancée a letter like this midway through their protracted betrothal. I cannot profess to offer any elaborate explanation of your mother's disquiet, but I admit it does not wholly surprise me. You see, I happen to know one factor in the case and one only of which you are wholly ignorant. I know you. I know one thing which has made me feel strange before your mother. I know the value of what I take away. I feel in a weird moment like the angel of death. Oh, dearest, dearest Francis, let us always be very gentle to older people. Indeed, darling, it is not they who are the tyrants, but we. They may interrupt our building in the scaffolding stages. We turn their house upside down when it is their final home and rest. Your mother would certainly have worried if you had been engaged to the Archangel Michael, who indeed is bearing his disappointment very well. How much more when you were engaged to an aimless, tactless, reckless, unbrushed, strange-headed, opinionated scarecrow, who as something walked into the vacant place. I could have prophesied her unrest. Wait, and she will calm down all right, dear. God comfort her. I dare not. And with their wedding in June of 1901, Frances firmly took her husband in hand, decked him out in new togs that included a dashing brigand's hat and cloak, perhaps even smashed a bottle of champagne over his head, and the good ship JKC finally set out in full-time sail on journalism's open sea. He quickly made a splash as an essayist and literary critic, writing in that highly flamboyant and personal style that seized the attention of readers and editors who clamored and negotiated for more. As we have seen, Chesterton's mind was always open to distractions and different facets of any subject he tackled, and by quickly overcommitting himself to virtually any newspaper or magazine that came calling, he began to take on the persona of the absent-minded genius, which became so large a part of his legend. In other books and articles of the period, one is always coming across sightings of Chesterton, halting traffic on Fleet Street as he stands in the middle of the road, scribbling on bits of paper, distractedly ordering dinner in restaurants while debating with his friends, then letting that dinner go cold, once misplacing a fried egg which he swept off the table while gesturing to make a point, dining at the House of Commons with a boot on one foot and a slipper on the other. Perhaps his dresser was down with a cold that day. Stopping himself suddenly in town one day, certain he was forgetting an appointment, and wiring home to Francis, "Am in Market Harborough. Where ought I to be?" But Chesterton's absence of mind in daily affairs only evinced his astonishing presence of mind in other matters. Imagine the shock of the bored journalist who asked this dithering eccentric which book he'd take to the proverbial desert island. And Chesterton calmly answered, "I think I should take Thomas's Guide to Practical Shipbuilding." It wasn't just a brilliant riposte, he named an actual book. Asked in a public debate to comment on the apparent success of the female enfranchisement movement, Chesterton gave spontaneous utterance to the kind of zinger that most writers could spend a week constructing and polishing. 20 million young women rose to their feet with the cry, "We will not be dictated to," and promptly became stenographers. Lecturing once on Dante's Inferno at Notre Dame College in the States, he dealt at some length with a supplementary question and then tried to get back on track by asking, "Now, where in hell were we?" On the page, levity and fun are almost always part of the proceedings, but the insights go deeper, ranging from the fairly straightforward, "There is more simplicity in the man who eats caviar on impulse than the man who eats grape nuts on principle," to the cockamamie, "The relations of the sexes are mystical, are and ought to be irrational. Every gentleman should take off his head to a lady." And from the paradoxical, "For children are innocent and crave justice, while most of us are wicked and naturally prefer mercy," to the profound, "The whole difference between construction and creation is exactly this, that a thing constructed can only be loved after it is constructed, but a thing created is loved before it exists." There are single paragraphs in Chesterton's work, and one's coming up right now, a tangent hailing from his critical study of Charles Dickens, that contain more original ideas than most writers manage to juggle in a book. Quote, "People talk with a quite astonishing gravity about the inequality or equality of the sexes, as if there possibly could be any inequality between a lock and a key. Wherever there is no element of variety, wherever all the items literally have an identical aim, there is at once and of necessity inequality. A woman is only inferior to a man in the matter of being not so manly. She is inferior in nothing else. Man is inferior to woman insofar as he is not a woman. There is no other reason. And the same applies in some degree to all genuine differences. It is a great mistake to suppose that love unites and unifies men. Love diversifies them, because love is directed toward individuality. Where did I go? I just got lost. The thing that really unites men and makes them like to each other is hatred. The more modern nations detest each other, the more meekly they follow each other. For all competition is in its nature only a furious plagiarism. As competition means always similarity, it is equally true that similarity always means inequality. If everything is trying to be green, some things will be greener than others. But there is an immortal and indestructible equality between green and red. As I say, that paragraph above is a flourish, off to the side of his main subject. Early on in the book, and writing at a time when not so much was known about Dickens's appalling treatment of his wife, nor the tetchiness of his relations with his publishers and professional colleagues, Chesterton latched on to a situation from Dickens' infancy and brilliantly employed it as a kind of template for his entire life and career. Commenting on how Dickens's father used to get the boy to sing songs and provide entertainment for his elders, Chesterton writes, "Some of the earliest glimpses we have of Charles Dickens show him to us perched on some chair or table singing comic songs in an atmosphere of perpetual applause. So almost as soon as he can toddle, he steps into the glare of the footlights. He never stepped out of it until he died. Dickens had all his life the faults of the little boy who is kept up too late at night. The boy in such a case exhibits a psychological paradox. He is a little too irritable because he is a little too happy. Like the overwrought child in society, he was splendidly sociable, and yet suddenly quarrelsome. In all the practical relations of his life, he was what the child is in the last hour of an evening party. Genuinely delighted, genuinely delightful, genuinely affectionate and happy, and yet, in some strange way, fundamentally exasperated and dangerously close to tears." Chesterton's biography of Dickens was an enormous commercial and critical success, his first real breakthrough, inspiring one typical reviewer, almost echoing his old chums in the debating club, to declare that it marks the definite entry of its author into the serious walks of literature. The book not only established Chesterton, it re-established Dickens, as marked by the publication the very next year of the Everyman edition of Dickens's entire oeuvre, with specially commissioned introductions by Chesterton to all 24 volumes. When you pick up a book by G.K. Chesterton, you are imbibing stories and essays, often journalism, that is 85 to 120 years old. How can it still be interesting, so applicable to life and the world as we know them today? Only because the man unfailingly bypassed almost everything we think of as news, and wrote instead about all of those trivial and cosmic matters that will fascinate and bedevil the human race unto extinction, like books and ideas, religion and love, beer and Skittles, cheese and croquet. Nothing is too common or insignificant to look at again with new eyes. The fact that anything was taken for granted or overlooked was, for Chesterton, a flashing signal that he probably stumbled upon something here of fundamental importance. I give you some essay titles selected at random. "On Lying in Bed." And how's this for an irresistible opening sentence? Lying in bed would be an altogether perfect and supreme experience if only one had a colored pencil long enough to draw on the ceiling. "What I Found in My Pocket." "On Running After One's Hat." An activity which Chesterton claimed was only slightly less embarrassing than running after one's wife. "Logic and Lawn Tennis." "The Glory of Gray." You get the idea. Chesterton loved the rough and sloppy world of journalism, regarded himself as a journalist first and a serious writer not at all. "I would rather live now and die from an artistic point of view," he said, "than keep aloof and write things that will remain in the world hundreds of years after my death." He liked journalism's immediacy of response, the give and take, and the tussling with an enormous audience. When book contracts started to come his way, he wouldn't scale back his journalistic commitments, and his appalling working habits didn't change either. in preparation for his numerous biographies of writers and saints. He would routinely get his secretary to gather together mountains of pertinent material, and after the most desultory of scans, he would plow ahead and write the books, mostly from memory and illumination. Anything doing is worth doing badly, he said, by way of explaining how even his own autobiography is riddled with incorrect dates and incidents out of sequence. He was scarcely more careful than writing about other men's lives. And many of those biographies come with a fair share of the kind of mistakes that are known to give more punctilious librarians the hives. When George Bernard Shaw reviewed Chesterton's 1909 book-length study of him and the nation, he enthused that this is the best work of literary art that I have yet provoked, but then threw in this qualifier. Everything about me which Mr. Chesterton had to divine, he has divined miraculously. But everything that he could have ascertained by reading my own plain directions on the bottle, as it were, remains for him a muddled and painful problem. The value of these books when they worked, and no one denies the brilliance of his Dickens, Browning, St. Francis, or Thomas Aquinas, wasn't their biographical veracity. The strokes were much too broad and reckless for that, as their author's uncanny ability to isolate and magnify the important truths that no one had ever latched onto before. Etienne Gilson, the renowned Thomistic scholar, who devoted entire volumes to single facets of Aquinas' life and thought, greeted the appearance of Chesterton's 180-page study of the saint by saying, "Chesterton makes one despair. I have been studying St. Thomas all of my life. I could never have written such a book." Chesterton's two literary surveys, The Victorian Age and Literature, a book which was commissioned and then prefaced with a short disclaimer by the nervous English publishing house of Williams and Norgate, and The Heretics, a book-length dispute with most of the influential writers of the Edwardian era, also displayed to stunning effect his knack for diving through walls of preconceptions and cliches and emerging with new and essential insights. In the fields of the novel and poetry, Chesterton's reputation hasn't fared so well. Poetically, he excelled at comic verse and ballads, scoring achievements and popularity in his day, but is currently ignored by critics and academics who seem to have this thing against any modern poet who would exhibit such bad taste as to be a practicing Christian, to cheerfully shun despair, and to rhyme. Anthologists such as Kingsley Amis and W.H. Auden always included a few of his verses, but for the most part, Chesterton's poetry, accessible, populist, and rhythmically stirring, couldn't be more at odds, more delightfully irrelevant to contemporary and dominant poetic trends. Just to give you a taste, let me inflict one of his shorter poems on you, and in its day, more than a century ago, one of his most beloved, The Donkey. When fishes flew and forests walked and figs grew upon thorn, some moment when the moon was blood, then surely I was born. With monstrous head and sickening cry and ears like errant wings, the devil's walking parody on all four-footed things. The tattered outlaw of the earth of ancient crooked will, starve, scourge, deride me, I am dumb. I keep my secrets still. Fools, for I also had my hour, one far, fierce hour and sweet. There was a shout about my ears, palms before my feet. Although I cherish many of his novels and stories, I feel a little sorry for anyone who first approaches Chesterton through his fiction. He never created a full character in his life, but preferred to dress up ideas in human form and make them fight and dance. While some of his mysteries required that he create the semblance of a plot, these never received half so much of his attention as the weirdly charged atmospheres and settings of these tales and the moral and philosophical debates which ensued at their climax. The Father Brown mysteries were so hugely popular in their day that they supported both Chesterton's household and that less than profitable weekly newspaper that bore the first two initials of his name. But nowadays, it's Chesterton fanatics and not your usual mystery buffs who have much use for the Father Brown series at all. Too bad for them. They're missing out on some great stuff. Consider this little gem of a speech from The Flying Stars, in which the dashing criminal Flambeau has disappeared into the upper reaches of a stand of trees at night, and Father Brown beseeches him from below to give back the diamonds whose theft has framed an innocent young man. I want you to give them back, Flambeau, and I want you to give up this life. There is still youth and honor and humor in you. Don't fancy they will last in that trade. Men may keep a sort of level of good, but no man has ever been able to keep on one level of evil. That road goes down and down. The kind man drinks and turns cruel. The frank man kills and lies about it. Many a man I've known started like you to be an honest outlaw, a merry robber of the rich, and ended stamped into slime. I know the woods look very free behind you, Flambeau. I know that you could melt into them like a monkey. But someday you will be an old gray monkey. You will sit up in your free forest, cold at heart and close to death, and the treetops will be very bare. Your downward steps have begun. You used to boast of doing nothing mean, but you are doing something mean tonight. You are leaving suspicion on an honest boy with a good deal against him already. You are separating him from the woman he loves and who loves him. But you will do meaner things than that before you die. Chesterton based the character of his priest detective on his good friend, Father John O'Connor. Father O'Connor, who not only brought first him and a couple years later Francis into the Catholic Church, seems to have perpetrated the only known instance of a fictional character writing a book about his author. When he published a delightful memoir of their friendship, Father Brown on Chesterton, the year after Chesterton's death. Shortly after the two men met at a weekend house party, they set out together on a three-hour conversational ramble on the moors, during which Chesterton learned rather more than he thought a priest could possibly know about crime and depravity. He simply hadn't appreciated, what with the confessional, prison visits, ministering to the injured, the dying, and the bereaved, what sort of hair-raising, heart-wrenching scenarios a priest would be privy to. After they got back to the house and dinner and post-prandial chat with several other guests, Father O'Connor said his goodnight and toddled off to bed. Two hardy Cambridge undergraduates then leaned forward in their seats to say, initially, what a fine and intelligent chap he seemed. But then, succumbing to the same pedestrian assumption as Chesterton fell for earlier that day, how artificial it all seemed, and how pitiful in a way that a priest's celibate and cloistered existence should keep him in ignorance about the deeper and darker realities of life. Chesterton reflected, to me, almost shivering with the appallingly practical facts of which the priest had warned me. The comment came with such a colossal and crushing irony that I nearly burst into a loud, harsh laugh in the drawing room. For I knew perfectly well that as regards all the solid Satanism which the priest knew and warred against with all his life, these two Cambridge gentlemen, luckily for them, knew about as much of real evil as two babies in the same perambulator. Some of his novels, like Napoleon of Notting Hill, The Man Who Was Thursday, and The Ball of the Cross, take the form of elaborately weird existential comedies and read like the work of a decidedly non-suicidal Franz Kafka. Of all his novels, my own favorite is Man Alive, in which the Chestertonian stand-in of a main character named Innocent Smith is hauled before an improvised court to face charges of burglary, bigamy, and attempted murder. But the only house he breaks into is his own, in a bid to revive the thrill of ownership. The woman he elopes with is his wife, so he can revisit the ecstasy of first love. And the only people he points his pistol at are dreary mopes who say they're tired of life until he presents them with the possibility of losing it. Maisie Ward calls Man Alive the Chestertonian acid test. If you can stand it, you can stand anything he wrote. He is so cheerful, so funny, so brilliant in his book that he is obnoxious. The books that sell the most copies today are his two greatest works in Christian apologetics, Orthodoxy, which he called his slovenly spiritual autobiography, and The Everlasting Man, a God-centered history of the world, his answer to H.G. Wells' Outline of History. These books stand alone with some of the books of C.S. Lewis, who himself was profoundly influenced by Chesterton as the best Christian apologetics of the 20th century. But as we saw with the lament about the lack of indexes in Chesterton's books, wonderful insights about the faith have a way of turning up in everything he wrote. I treasure this illuminating, and of course paradoxical, excerpt from Heretics whenever I'm being badgered by some secularist who condemns Christianity for its life-choking gloominess and unhealthy preoccupations with guilt and sin. Quote, "The fall is a view of life. It is not only the most enlightening, but the only encouraging view of life. It holds, as against the only real alternative philosophies, those of the Buddhist or the pessimist or the Promethean, that we have misused a good world and not merely been entrapped in a bad one. It refers evil back to the wrong use of will and thus declares that it can eventually be righted by the right use of will. Every other creed but that one is some form of surrender to fate." Quote. Let me leave you with a final note about paradox. It is another of those words, like inexhaustible, that is much associated with Chesterton. The term denotes an apparent contradiction, which on closer inspection turns out to be oddly complementary and even meaningful. And the only books I know which pack as many paradoxes to the page as just about any book of Chesterton's are some of those books which we find in the Holy Bible. Whereas a mere contradiction just cancels itself out in an act of linguistic Harry Carey and he's thought of no more, the constituent elements in a good, rich paradox emphasize and intensify each other until they start vibrating with the multifaceted beauty of lively coexistence and take up permanent residence in our consciousness. Chesterton's uncanny knack for coining paradoxes is either celebrated as one of his hallmarks or condemned as a tiresome trick. Now, the sad truth is that not everybody cares for these verbal explosions of compounded meaning, and I think that might explain why Chesterton actually bewilders and irritates some readers. They can't get a handle on him. They can't tell when he's serious. He's always serious, or at least sincere. They think he writes like he's on drugs. But as I explained earlier, Chesterton is my literary drug of choice. In his poetry or his prose, his fiction or his essays, at the top of his form or not, I always find in Chesterton an affirmation of life and gratitude for its gift, an unflagging and contagious sense of wonder and amazement at the world in which he lives. Chesterton was fond of recalling an old riddle from his childhood. What did the first frog say when he finally met God? "Lord, how you made me jump!" That, too, was an exclamation of thanks and a distillation of the wonderful spirit of this man, ungainly, high-spirited, grotesquely beautiful, jumping for joy in the face of God. Thanks for planning that. I don't have a thing to say about it. I'd have to think about that a long time. Yeah, that's a good rich field. That's worth an essay.
I didn't plan it. It just came to me.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first things that occurs to me is, I think this, with Lewis, he's always sabotaged by it. just grabs him. He's reading Beatrix Potter. He's building a fort with his brother with the spruce boughs.
He's ambushed by joy.
Yeah.
And Chesterton plays with gratitude.
Yeah. And I think, in a funny way, Chesterton reads his way to it.
Okay.
He reasons his way to it. He creates his way. Whereas, at least in the beginning, that's all I'm going to say for now, but I think that might be a distinction. I think with Chesterton, it's a little more deliberate, and with Lewis, he just gets sabotaged.
Thanks, Aaron.
Well, while we're waiting for other questions, and in fact, that may be it, I would just let you know there's a fine selection of books back there. Two really good authors. Me, and would you believe it? G.K. Chesterton. So feel free to buy some of those. I'll bet that's all we have to talk about. And it went on a long time, didn't it? I'm sorry that it took so long, but I hope it was reasonably interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.